Well, I am going to preach a normal sermon in an hour, and I'm going to preach an abnormal sermon now. That's good. I appreciate that. Well, I talked to my wife last night when I got back to the Reed's house, and I told her that this is a really friendly bunch of folks. So you have impressed me very much with who you are and who you're trying to be like, and it's just a pleasure to be with you. I don't know that I think about it every day, but I think about it quite often that it's I think about what my life would be like if I weren't a Christian, and that's not a pleasant thing. It's not a good thing, and I just value the fact that I've had parents who have taught me the way of God, and that continue to live life, I think, the way the Lord intends for them to live it, and that they've had an influence on me. And so the things that I want to talk to you about this morning are things that are pertinent because most of us are, in some way, have been parents or are parents, and we're trying to teach our kids. And so I want to talk to you about that this morning, and as Marshall said, I want to conduct this kind of as a class. So if I ask a question, I would prefer that you try to give me some input to that, if you will. But again, it's a pleasure to be with you today. If I ask you this morning, and I am asking you, what is the most, this is a very ambiguous question, and I'm well known for that. When I've taught some college classes, I'll ask questions and they look at me like, we have no idea what you're asking for. And so I said, well, let me ask it again. And they still have no idea. So I'll do the best I can with this question. But if you were asked, what is the most difficult thing for a person to do? What would you say? I mean, now, isn't that ambiguous? But what would you say? This is completely out of the blue. Change? Somebody say change? Yeah, that's pretty good. That's a pretty good answer. Now, well, we're on the same wavelength anyway. That's pretty good. I'm impressed by that. Change, all right. Can you think of something else maybe? Oh, that's a good one. Now you're kind of thinking with me here. Okay, I like that. That's hard. What else? She said to deny oneself. That's good. What else? Okay. Oh, now we're getting biblical. That's good. Since this is a Sunday morning and we're here, that's good. That's good. That's good. Like, yeah. What else? Yes, sir.
Grief.
And what? Just to deal with, right? Yes. I think that's a great answer. Good answer. What else?
To live totally unselfishly.
Okay. To live unselfishly. Man, I'm getting all sorts of good answers. I feel a series coming on. Don't you, Marshall? Y'all may get this here in a few weeks. These are great answers. What else? You still haven't gotten my answer, but I'm going to give it to you whether you want to hear it or not.
Forgive.
Okay, to be a people who's willing to forgive. That's a hard thing, yeah.
To learn to acquire character.
Okay. Expand on that a little bit. Well, that's true. It's true. Just to develop that. Okay. Good. Now we're at recognize when you don't. That's kind of moving toward where I want to go. Yeah. Okay. Now you're thinking in terms of what I want to talk about a little bit more. In a minute, I'm not going to get there first, but that's good.
Admit when you're wrong.
All right, now we're getting close. Admit when I'm wrong. We're getting warmer. You play again. No, you're colder, you're warmer. We're getting warmer.
Yeah, just to learn my mind and what makes me think
of the right direction. Okay. Oh, we're getting a lot warmer. This is good. I almost feel something working. Now that sounds bad. I don't mean feel something working. That didn't sound right coming into the Bible class, did it?
Distinguish between learning a lesson and being taught a lesson.
Okay. Good. Anything else? Okay. Since you've asked me to come, I better tell you what I think, right? I think the most difficult thing for a person to do is to be honest with oneself. I think that's the most difficult thing. Now, you've touched on all those things that you've mentioned. It's kind of part of that. But I want you to think about that. When you're totally honest with yourself, what does that will change you. That will do some of the things that will help with some of the things that even we're talking about. And what in the Bible, especially in the New Testament, what is a phrase that kind of helps a person and makes a person think? Well, sometimes that's difficult for us to do. Remember a phrase, I'll give you a hint, which found once in 1 Corinthians 15:33. What's the phrase that begins that verse? Talking about evil companions. Do not be deceived. Do not be deceived. You know, we think about, there are several places in Scripture that begin with do not be deceived. And why do you think that those inspired writers begin with do not be deceived? Because it's so easy to be deceived. I think that's the point. It's easy to be deceived. 5 or 6 years ago, my doctor, who happened to be a personal friend, I was there, had come for a physical, and he said, you better really start watching what you eat. And I said, I look at everything I eat. He said, that's not what I mean. He said, you just better be careful because you're developing. You could very easily develop diabetes. And I kind of thought, well, you know, okay. So for a couple of days, I really watched what I ate. He said, you need to exercise more. So I did for a couple of days. Actually, it was a couple of weeks. And I would watch. And so in about a month, I went back and he said, it's better. Whatever you're doing, it's better. And you need to keep doing that. Do you think I did? No, because that's why I'm telling you the story, right? It wouldn't make sense if I'd done it because it wouldn't fit what I'm trying to tell you, right? So, and really what I did, I kept evaluating myself. And I when I'd go to lunch, I'd think, well, you know, that's probably, I feel pretty good. I feel good today. Slept pretty well, feel pretty good. So I'd eat pretty much what I wanted. And then that afternoon, I'd think about exercising. And I wouldn't, but I'd think about it. I thought about it a lot, thinking, well, that might help me. But eventually, I went back to a doctor after a few years, about a year and a half ago, and he said, no, you have diabetes. And you're going to, not only do you have it, you're going to have to start taking some insulin. And I begged him, I do not want to do that. He said, well, okay, you don't have to, but it's not going to be pretty. And I said, well, okay, then I'll do it. And what he taught me was that I wasn't honest with myself. I mean, back when my friend, who happened to be my physician, said, you need to change what you're doing, I just kind of disregarded that. I just kind of acted like that's not a big deal. And now, while it is somewhat under control, and I am trying to do some things, instead of eating 2 hamburgers, I usually eat 1.5 or maybe 1. No, I'm just kidding about that. But I try to watch and I try to change a little bit. So I'm trying to be a little bit more honest. But that's hard. It's hard when it has to do with your health. It's hard when it has to do sometimes with, you know, if some of you are in school, it has to do with your grades. You know, you wonder why at the end of the semester you have a C when you did great average work. You know, you've deceived yourself. You've convinced yourself that I think that happens in every facet of life. And so I'm just asking you this morning, what are some ways in which you deceive yourself? And I think one of those ways sometimes is as parents. As parents, we think that somehow we've tried to be the kind of godly parents that we need to be, and somehow later in life when our kids leave, that while we haven't done the things that we needed to do, sometimes we think, okay, but when they're older, everything's going to be fine. And we kind of deceive ourselves. And I bring all that up because the idea of deception and if you will, dishonesty with oneself, I think that permeates every facet of life. But I see it a lot in parents. I have a good friend now who worships with us where I'm preaching now in Alabama. And by the way, some of you know that I've lived in Florida a long time, and I have, but now I live in Alabama. I'm preaching there. That's beside the point. I just wanted you to know that in case you didn't. But a friend of mine, we were talking about his boys. He has three boys and a young girl, four children. And in my conversation with him, he is concerned. He is concerned about his children. And having been there and having gotten to know his children, I know why. I know why he's concerned. But in my talking with him, it's almost like I'm expecting when as they get older that things are going to change. And I'm not so sure that that's going to happen. I would hope that it's going to happen, but I'm not so sure. So I want us to think this morning about maybe some things that we can do as parents and things that we can give our children and things that we ought to give our children. My wife is Beth, and she and I are empty nesters. Many of you have gone through that already. But, you know, now what we do is we go to bed and the house is quiet and the conversation almost always goes back to the kids. I don't know if that's happened with you, if you're empty nesters, but that's what's happened to us. And the way it goes back is we evaluate. See, they just, our youngest is 20 years old. He is a college, he's a junior in college. Our other two have already graduated, and so Beth and I lie in bed, and we talk about each of our kids, and we evaluate. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think, after we evaluate, do you think we feel good, or do you think we feel bad? The answer to that is yes. We feel both. We feel both, and we feel both because there are things that we've done that we feel good about in looking back, but there are things that we've done that we don't feel good about. And because our kids are in this transition phase, and guess what? We're in a transition phase. I made a tactical mistake. I moved my wife from a place that she had lived for 30 years to a place that she grew up at, but 30 years prior. And so we changed jobs. She left her job. I took a new job. We moved to a new place. Our kids left house. And all of those kind of I did that at one time. If I could do that again, I probably wouldn't do all that at the same time. That's just a little side note for those of you who are thinking about what you're going to do. But anyway, be that as it may. We're asking now, what is it that we've given them? What is it that we gave our kids? And I want you to think about that with me this morning. You remember in Matthew 16, you remember the statement that Jesus made in Matthew 16, 26? The verse starts with a preposition, for. For what shall, here we go, it profit a man if he gained the whole world and loses his own soul? Or what's the second phrase? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? As I think about that in the evaluation process, it's kind of come back to those verses a little bit. And really what I'm trying to think of is, in terms of worldly or materialistic things, would you say that all of you can give or are giving or have given your children worldly and materialistic things? Would you agree with that? Sure. It's part of the process. We want to help our kids. We want to give them. And, you know, many times, you know, the generation, my parents' generation gave me and my sister so much. And I think it's developed into a mentality among maybe people my age of trying to do the same for our children, maybe even giving in more. And I'm not going to get into all of that. That may be a judgment that you have to make, how much is too much and all that kind of thing. But my point to that is that varies. Okay, that varies. On my way out here, I flew from Birmingham, Alabama, to Houston on the first leg of my flight. I did that Friday morning, so I'll just tell you, there were a lot of people on my plane that had a particularly strong interest in a particular college football team that played in the state of Texas yesterday. I am from Alabama, but that's not my team, just so you know, so you don't stone me to death before I get out of here. But anyway, a friend of mine who is a pilot, and is a personal pilot for a company that is privately owned and is very successful. Kyle knew that I was going to Birmingham, and I had about 6 hours, 6 or 7 hours to wait in the airport. He said, let me make a phone call. He said, I want to call, and because he's a pilot, because he works for a business that has their own jets and all that kind of thing, he said, let me make a call and see if it's okay for you to go to where we normally go to just wait. It's off-site, but it'll be much more convenient for you and all that. And I thought, this is good. You know, this is good. I'll have to sit in the airport. Don't have to pay $11 for a bottle of water and all that kind of stuff. I said, this is good. So he did, and I went to this place called Atlantic Aviation that sits off-site at the Birmingham Airport. And while I was there, I mentioned this to Marshall when he picked me up at the airport. But while I was there, a man named Bart Starr walked in. Some of you remember the name Bart Starr. Bart Starr was the quarterback for the University of Alabama, and was the quarterback for the Green Bay Packers when they won the Super Bowl. Bart Starr is pretty famous when you get to be old like me. You remember a guy like that. And he came up to me and introduced himself. And very nice man. I called him Mr. Starr, and he said, there's no Mr. Starr here. It's Bart. And I said, okay, which was nice. And then a few minutes later, a man came in, and there were six men with him. They were all dressed in dark suits and dark ties, and two of them carried pistols. And I thought, well, something's going on here. Well, I'd only been in the state of Alabama for 4 months. And so in a few minutes, my friend Kyle, who just happened to had found out that morning, he had to fly into Birmingham. He walked in, and he and I were talking, and he said, do you know who that is? And I said, no. He said, that's the governor. I said, the governor of Alabama? He said, yeah, that's the governor, Richard Bentley. So I've seen Bart Starr. I've seen the governor. I'm not name dropping. I'm just overwhelmed. You know, I'm from Ball Knob, Arkansas. I've seen Bart Starr and the governor of Alabama in about an hour's time, and I thought, this is pretty cool. So I sat back down. And here's what I started noticing. There were families that were flying in to this private runway. And these kids were getting off. These families were coming. These kids were getting off. I mean, and the luggage they were carrying, and the clothes they were wearing, and the cars they were coming in, I was thinking, man, this is serious business. I mean, these people got more money than they know what to do with. And when Kyle showed me the jet that he had flown in on, he said, come on, let me show you what I'm flying. And when I said, how much does that cost? He said, in excess of $6 million. And I'm thinking, you know, that's pocket change to these people. And he said, that's about right. And here's my point for telling you all that. I saw these kids walking in, and I thought, what is it that these kids are really getting? They've got all this stuff. They have all this privilege. And yet, probably, these kids are some of the most abused kids in the world. Because my guess is, and I don't know this for a fact, but my guess is, most of those kids aren't being taught much about God. And the things that are most important in their life, they're probably not discussing because they have so much of the other things. And I thought, this is a problem. And I went back, and as I sat there, I started thinking about a passage like 2 Timothy 1. Turn over, if you would, in your New Testaments to 2 Timothy, the first chapter. You'll be familiar with this, I'm sure. 2 Timothy 1, Paul would say this to Timothy in verse 5 particularly. He said, when I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also. Here was something that I thought, as I was watching all this privilege, I thought, what is it that is really important as a parent? What is it that I can give them? Even if I had all this money, even if I had all this ability to give them everything materialistically that they not only wanted, but that I wanted to give them, what would be the great benefit with that? And then I thought about, here's a mother. Let me ask you this. When we think of Timothy, when in the Bible are we introduced to this young man? You remember? on the second missionary journey. When in the book of Acts, you remember which chapter we're introduced to Timothy? Turn over to Acts 16. Look at Acts 16. We're introduced to him, as Marshall mentioned, on this second missionary journey. And here's what Luke records about that. Verse 1, then he came to Derbe and Lystra, referring to Paul. And behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman, who believed, but his father was Greek. He was well spoken of by the brethren who were at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted to have him go on with him, and he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region, for they all knew that his father was Greek. Here are two women, Lois and Eunice, a grandmother and a mother. And they must have been just wonderful women. Their hearts must have been spiritually minded. They obviously, when Paul came to this, very probably, well, we know on the first journey, when he came and when he began to talk to them about the gospel, this family was probably converted because they probably had a strong conviction about God in the first place. And Timothy is converted. And when you get to Acts 16, as Paul comes back through and he's talking about Timothy, I think it's significant that verse 2 says he was well spoken of by the brethren. Here's a young guy, young man, I don't know how young, but relatively young. And the people who are the brethren, those who are the spirit of the Christians, the spiritual leaders, and those who are part of his life like that, they're impressed with him. And I like to make the point about Timothy that his reputation, and I think his character was such that the brethren really thought well of him. So let me just stop here real quick and let me ask you young people. If I said to this group, what about you? And I've done this with people that I know very well. I'm not going to do that this morning. But if I mentioned one of you and I said, this morning I'm just going to start. I'll do it with Greg because he's older, and he's smiling at me at least right now. But if I said I'm going to start over here, and I want everybody to tell me what you think of Greg. Greg Perkins, I want everybody to tell me. Well, I think I probably know what I'd hear. I mean, he's one of your shepherds. I think I know what I'm going to hear about Greg Perkins. But what am I going to hear about Greg Perkins and Christy Perkins' kids? What's their reputation? What are you going to say about them? And again, you know, that we could take this a step. We could take this with everybody. What do people say about you? And if you're young this morning, what are people saying about you? What, as they observe you and as they hear about you, what's the conclusion that they reach about you? And I like what it said about Timothy. Timothy was well spoken of by the brethren, not only in his hometown, but in towns 50 and 60 miles away. Now that's not a big deal. Now we know everybody all across the country. But here, when you're talking about a reputation of a young man that's like this, there's something about his training that was tremendous. And it happened from two women, a grandmother, evidently a grandmother and a mother, the father was Greek. He wasn't even a New Testament Christian, evidently. We don't know that necessarily for sure, but it seemed like that's the point, that one of the points that's being made about that. And his reputation was such that when Paul came back, Paul said, that's who I want to take. Now I want you to think about what was being asked. He's taking this young man because he needs somebody. What's he doing? He's preaching the gospel and reaching people who are lost, and he needs a young man. He needs somebody like Timothy, and because he's so well spoken of, Paul pays special attention to him. I'm going to tell you the kind of young man he is. He's the type of young man that is willing, when he finds out, when Paul says, Timothy, I'd like to take you. Timothy is a young man, and I want to be careful about this, but I think it's stated because it is a great point. As an adult male, he chooses to be circumcised. That's a difficult thing. And he chooses that because he knows what he is about to do. And it would be to his advantage, you see. going into these Jewish synagogues, as he would then do as he joins Paul, it would be to his advantage. So this is the kind of young man that we're talking about. And we know ultimately what Paul thought about him. Paul would later call him his, you remember, what did he call Timothy? My son in the faith. I mean, that's what he thought of this. That's what he thought of this young man. And what I want to suggest to you is that didn't come by accident. That didn't come by accident. And it not only didn't come by accident, it came from, it seems to me, and I'm not suggesting that it only came from these two women, but when Paul would later in 2 Timothy 1, when he would say, I'm reminded of the faith that was in your grandmother and your mother, and he said, and you remember in the 2 Timothy 1 passage, he says, after he says that, he says, but and I am what? I am persuaded that it's in you also. Don't you find that to be strange language? I mean, he's writing to a son in the faith, and he says, I'm persuaded. I think the tone, if you go back, and I'd prefer you not do it right now, but if you go back and you read the book of 2 Timothy, especially those early chapters, well, there's only three, but if you go back and look at the first chapter particularly, he asked him, don't be ashamed, and some things like that. I think it's almost, and I don't want to overstate the case, and I may be wrong about this, but it's almost like Paul is saying, Timothy, I want to remind you of your past. I want to remind you of what happened with your mother and with your grandmother. And I want to remind you of the genuine faith that they had and that I am persuaded is in you also. It may be that as Paul writes what probably is his last letter, and particularly to Timothy, that maybe he'd heard some things, or maybe he just knew Timothy was discouraged, or whatever the case. But the way he does that is, he goes back and he says, I'm persuaded that what you need is what your grandmother and your mother have. Now, let me just say that. Let me just say something about that. I very much think that it is to a child's advantage, and I'm going to state the obvious here, to have a mother and father who are strong Christians. That's exactly what God intends. I mean, that you can't read Scripture from Genesis 2 on. You can't read Scripture and not reach that conclusion, and there's a lot we could say about that. But what God intends is for a husband and a wife to marry, for them to be the kind of people they ought to be, and then for them to raise the kind of children that they ought to raise. And that's the way God intends for it to be. But in this case, you have a mother and a grandmother who it seems like, have less than ideal circumstances, and yet they raise this kind of boy. That's pretty impressive stuff. That's pretty impressive stuff. And my guess is that when they get later on in life, when they look at that, they are grateful that they're able to raise that kind of young man. Now, a lot of things have to happen a lot, but let me ask you this question. If you're a parent, This is one of those. This is kind of one of these honesty deals. Okay, this is where I'm asking you. I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to really be honest with this. Okay, if your children could be your age right now, would it be okay with you if they had your faith? That's pretty sobering, isn't it? Would you be okay if your children were your age, at your age right now, if they had your faith, and as a result of that, then would you be okay if they stood before God and said, God, this is my life. This is what I've done. This is who I am. Are you okay with that? If you're a mother, are you okay with your daughter standing before God and your daughter looking at God and saying, I'm basically my mother. I have her faith. I mean, it's my own faith, but she's the one who's helped cultivate that in me. Are you okay with that? See, that's the kind of questions that I think we need to ask. And we sometimes get so content on maybe giving them so much. And I'm not opposed to that. I've done the same for my children. I've tried to give them, I won't say as much as I can, but I've tried to make their life easier. But I've tried to do that, I think, like most, if not all of you, we've tried to do that so that we give them the things that are most important. Let me mention this because I don't want to forget this. Inevitably, when I talk about these kinds of things to a group of people like this, I can see in the hearts of in the eyes of some folks that it's hard. Because there are people who make mistakes. And there are people who aren't. And we all feel that way to some degree. But there are people who think, well, it's too late for me. Let me suggest something. Well, as a parent, you're not the only influence that your children have. I'm not trying to discount everything that I've said prior to this. But, you know, there are other influences. There are other reasons why the faith of your children isn't what it maybe should be. But we do have an influence. There is no doubt that we are that we're the first line of defense, if you will, or the first teaching really mechanism that children have. They see in us. But there are other factors that have to do with what happens to your children, and I realize that. But I want you to think about really from a child's standpoint, I want you to think about what we're ultimately giving to them. And especially when you think about a passage like, turn over to 2 Corinthians 4. Let me ask you to look at that. 2 Corinthians 4. I love these three verses, and I'm not going to talk about all of them right now, but I do want you to look at verse 18. While we do not, this is Paul, and again, when you look at chapter 4, he's talked about the things that he's had to go through, the things that his co-workers have had to go through. And when you get to verse 16, he says, "Therefore we do not lose heart, even though our outward man is perishing. Yet the inward man is being renewed day by day, for our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal." When you look at a passage like that, why is it that helping your children understand what's really important and really valuable in life? What does that passage say is one of the reasons why it's so difficult to help make that happen? What? We can't see it, or the things that we're looking at are, we can't see those eternal things. I think this is a challenge that a parent has. When we talk about what we're going to give, this is one of the greatest challenges that we have. When you're young, how do you feel when you're young? Physically, how do you feel? We feel good, right? What the research would tell us, that up until you're about 25, everything's moving kind of in a positive direction. You're at your peak physically at around 25. That gives every rest of us. We're depressed about that now, aren't we? You know, from about 25 on down, it starts kind of going downhill a little bit unless you really work at it. And then you get it maybe a few more years. But, you know, I understand that. I was, as most of you know, I was involved in college athletics and coached and played and all that kind of stuff. I decided it was probably 48 or so, about 48, 49 years old, I decided that my son was a freshman in college and he was playing basketball, and I decided I wanted to play in the alumni game. I said, I told the coach, I said, "I want to play against him." He said, "You do?" I said, "I sure do." So for 6 months, I prepared. I got myself in shape, if you want to call it that. I was already in a shape. It just wasn't the right kind of shape. But I got myself in better shape, and I decided I was going to play. I played 20 minutes of a 40-minute college basketball game. I was pretty excited about that. And 6 months later, I was still hurting. That's the truth. But I survived. That was my goal. I just want you to survive. I wanted to survive, and I did that. And I thought, you know, if I can help my kids understand that even as a young person, remember what that passage says? Even though our, what, outer man is perishing, yet our inward man is being renewed day by day. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to help my boys and my girl, my daughter, see that it's not just about getting older. It's about developing the inward man. And I'm going to talk to you this morning in the lesson. I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about that as I talk about raising spiritually minded children. What is it that we can do to help our kids? Help our kids be that. Now, I've done all the talking. I don't have much time, and there are some other things I want to say, but I'm going to take a little time here to ask you this question. I want you to give me some reasons. If the greatest thing that we can give our kids is this genuine kind of faith, this attitude that says, I understand what's really important in my life and what's really valuable, what are some things in our world, just real quickly, what are some things in our world that hinder that process, that make that hard for us to do? There may be things that we've already discussed, but just what are some things in the last few minutes that we talked about or that you can think of that make that hard? Yeah.
Technology. Yeah.
Big one. Media that relates to that a lot. Time commitments getting away. What? Friends. What? Sports. No. Oh, disregard what she said. Did I ask you to comment, Lisa? It's big. It's big. That was a big problem for me. You know, I want my kids to be great and everything. You know, I'm still waiting on that. That's a good point. Yes, ma'am. Okay. All right. Okay. I'm going to talk a little about that maybe in my lesson here in the next few minutes. But, you know, I can tell that's pretty close to your heart. Very close, right? Yeah. And again, we have to be careful there. You know, A lot of things about that as a parent you have to be careful about. That it happens with particular people, so that would be certainly something. What else? We got, 2 minutes? Can you think of anything else? What makes it hard?
Your own fault as a parent.
Oh, yeah. Your own fault as a parent. Do you have any faults? That's what happens when we go to bed at night now and we sit there and my wife says, well, we should have. And I hate it when she starts something, we should have, you know. And you know what I found out about my wife is she's usually right. I hate that too. But that's right, what we should have done. And you know what's interesting about that, folks? As a parent, how many shots do you have at it? You just got one. You talk about sobering. You talk about challenging. You talk about making you think. That's why when I'm talking to and when I'm trying to help younger parents, I really stress this stuff because you just got one shot at it. Now, again, the point that I was going to make a while ago that I actually forgot. What happens when after the fact you realize, hey, I should have done something different? Let me tell you something. You can always change. I had a man tell me one time I was preaching in Jacksonville, Florida, and this was way back. This tells you how far back it was. Got a letter from him. And he said, I need to tell you something. He said, I was just thinking about some things that you had said, and he said, I decided to, I called my daughter-in-law in Portland, Oregon, and he said, I told her I wanted to come out and see my son. And I did. He said, I flew out there. I hadn't seen him in 6 years. I flew out there and intentionally stayed 6 hours. From the time he got there to the time he left. And he said, I went out there for this purpose. I wanted to tell him that I was sorry. That I hadn't done things differently. And he said, I went out there and I spent a couple hours with him. And I told him that. And I got back on the plane. He said, I did that intentionally. I didn't want him thinking I came out there to visit. I'm coming out there to talk to you. And he said, I just got a letter from him. And he said, Dad, I realize that. And he said, I know you're sorry about that. And he said, I'm sorry for what I've done. And he said, I'm writing you because I want to tell you about the good things that are happening. He was going back to church and he had
done some things and made some changes in his life. And I'm saying that to you for this reason. Folks, you can always change. You can always change. And just do the very best you can and make amends to the very best way you can and in the very best way you can. And that'll be a good thing. Yes, sir. Well, yeah. Now I've got four more series that I'm working on. That was great. You know, he doesn't even know me, and I like the fact that you're willing to say that. And there's a lot about that we could talk about. And the world, it is different. It's me. How I raised my kids is different than how I was raised, like this gentleman said. And I think we just have to be real serious about what we're trying to do and not let the world dictate what we do in terms of being a parent. Let's make sure that when it's all said and done, when we're somewhere sitting in that rocking chair, and I know I got to quit, when my kids are raised, which is pretty much now, and I'm laying in that bed with my wife and evaluating what we've done, or I'm sitting in that rocking chair on that front porch and waiting on my grandkids to come home or whatever, let me do my dead level best to make sure that what I gave them was the most important thing I could give them. That's what we've got to do. And if you can sit here this morning and you say, I really haven't been doing that, then start doing that. That's what I would suggest to you. Start doing that. If you're not doing it, start doing it. And you'll be glad that you did. And your kids will be glad, and you'll be thankful, and they'll be thankful. So thank you very kindly for all your comments. Appreciate it.